This morning is a beautiful sunshiny day. Let us thank the Lord for a great day. Just a short prayer. Thank you, God, for all of your many gifts and for a beautiful day. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce Claudia Balducci. I've known her for a number of years, back when she was on the Bellevue City Council, and she became mayor there. A little bit of background on Claudia. She went to Providence College for her bachelor degree and then Columbia University for her law degree. According to Wikipedia, which we know is not always correct, she started out in labor negotiations.
Yeah.
All true, huh?
Yes.
All true, okay. She and her husband and their son are neighbors of ours. They live. You can run into Claudia at QFC up the street if you shop there, and that's how I wrangled her into becoming and speaking. I ran into her there. She is chair of the King County Council, represents District 6, and I would like to be the first to wish you an early happy birthday. Her birthday is this next week.
Wow.
So, Claudia is going to tell us a little bit about what's going on at King County and in the area. And by the way, she's a big supporter of Imagine Housing and homeless issues.
Thank you for the happy birthday.
You're welcome.
Good morning. I'm Claudia Balducci. I'm proud to be a King County Council member from this district right here. If you live north of I-90 in Bellevue, I am your council member, or if you live in the Points communities or on Mercer Island, I also represent about two-thirds of Redmond, about two-thirds of Kirkland. And as Sherry said, I've been in local politics for a long time, but I got involved not because I had ambitions about running for office or running for higher office, but because I got involved in a project by the city. In fact, I wasn't involved, I was just a neighbor. I got invited to a community meeting to talk about upzoning the Lake Hill Shopping Center, if you recall how it used to be, and then it got rezoned. And the city wanted to allow mixed use, allow some housing there, bigger units for, you know, larger families and rentals. And so many people came out to say, don't you dare do that. And I was and then that was surprising to me. So I got involved to say, I'm okay with having more housing for more neighbors. It's hard to live here. The homes my husband and I, maybe many of you live in, were starter homes for families back in the day. And that's just not reachable to people anymore. This was, you know, 20 years ago. So that's how I got involved. And as I've served on the city council and now on the county council, I've made housing and homelessness a real priority, also transportation. So I just want to start by thanking you all. The congregation and the people here of St. Andrews have been incredibly active in manifesting your values in the community, not just speaking out, but acting, creating a whole housing authority that now exists because of you all, and being strong supporters of values of inclusiveness, caring for those in need, and being a welcoming city. This is Welcoming Week in King County and around the country, and so I think it's a really appropriate time to thank those of you in the community who live that value. So thank you. At King County, we have a number of challenges ahead of us right now. Most of them have been exacerbated or created by the COVID pandemic. And I thought I would just give an overview of some of the things we're working on, and then we'll leave some time for question and answer for anything that you're interested in. So just as a reminder, King County is, of course, the regional government. Most of your local government, everything, all the services, the land use, et cetera, is the responsibility of the city of Bellevue. But we organize above all of the cities. We work with the cities, and we have some regional authority and services. So one of the things that we are responsible for is homelessness response. In recent years, as you know, homelessness has just ballooned across our county, despite a number of very targeted efforts and a lot of money to try to address it. And the value that we have, and I was so pleased when I joined the county council the first year I was there, we had our budget meeting, and most of my colleagues were just appalled by the amount of homelessness going around the courthouse outside of our own offices. Like, this is our home base and the homelessness there. And so we got to work, and people were really interested, and we found an interesting way to raise some new funds. It had to do with right-of-way charges. It's a boring, bureaucratic thing that doesn't affect anyone here, so I'm not going to bore you with it, but we came up with a way to raise $5 million and invest in new shelter capacity and new services right around the courthouse, because, you know, that's something that's a core value for most of us. In recent years, we spun off something called the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. You've heard of this. It's a multi-government collaboration between King County, Seattle, and all of the cities of King County, and a group called the Lived Experience Coalition, which is a representative of people who live in homelessness or have lived in homelessness. That organization has been up and running for just over a year now. We voted on it about 3 years ago, but it's really been running for about a year. And they've got two key innovations. One is collaboration. It is the real recognition that homelessness is a regional problem and that no one city, even one as large as the city of Seattle, is going to solve it on their own. That anything you do in one place, you have impacts elsewhere, and you don't meet everyone's needs. The second innovation is we built what we call lived experience right into all of our planning. We don't just sit around as people who live in homes and have always lived in homes and say, I know what to do, I've read a study or two and I've got some ideas. We bring in people and we ask them, what is your experience like? What works for you? What is the reason that you are home? You know, we try to make sure that we are meeting people where they are and hearing from them, and not just listening, but they sit at the table and have a vote. So it's a new way of doing business, and we've had a few interesting developments in that front. One is, and this was kind of depressing actually, but the first thing we did was we realized that our data was all wrong. The way we've been collecting information, which was a national standard, a one-night count, maybe some of you have volunteered and gone out and counted, not the greatest methodology. We knew it. Nobody thought that this was fully accurate, but it turns out when you look deeper at other data sources, like people who are getting services, or if you go and actually have peers go out and talk to people in homelessness and count, we get a count that's up to 3 times larger than what we thought it was. So there are a lot more people without homes in our community than we even knew. Probably not a surprise, but daunting, right? Our problem is bigger than we thought it was. On the positive front, we've funded up, by we I mean King County and Seattle have contributed a lot of funding to this group. And they have started to use what they call peer navigators. These are people who have been in homelessness who go out and help to connect people to services. You know, I mean, you all know David Bowling and Congregations for the Homeless. They had their offices here for many years. He will say, really helping people to move out of homelessness and stay stable and stay is about relationship building. People feel, they feel disconnected. They don't have the sort of human relationships that you need to be a stable person. And so this is what the peer navigators do. They create relationship. We don't go out and sweep encampments and tell people move. We work with them until they're ready to move. And we've seen some major successes, some very big, very scary places where there's been crime and people getting killed. And these are not great, some of these big encampments. People have agreed to go inside, and we've seen 70-80% success in housing those folks. And so that's what we need to do, but we need to scale it. So the next thing we're going to be talking about is how do we get this service out to the cities. We're making plans with the smaller cities like Bellevue and others. We're making plans with Seattle. So it's showing promise, but it's challenging. You may have read in the paper recently there's a little bit of, you know, rub between the mayor and the head of the agency, but that's okay. We're going to work through those things. The second big thing we've been doing, you may be more familiar with, is called Health Through Housing. This was an initiative that came up during the pandemic. So early on in the pandemic, Frank Chopp, Representative, former House Speaker Frank Chopp, created a funding mechanism that local jurisdictions could use to quickly house people in homelessness. And at the same time, the pandemic hit, and we had hotels going under at a very high rate because, of course, the tourism industry went down. And so King County, we enacted a sales tax, what we had, and used it to purchase now 15 hotels all around King County. And two of them are here on the east side. One is in the overlay part of Redmond. It's called the Silver Cloud Hotel, former Silver Cloud. One of them is in South Kirkland, the former La Quinta Inn. And these, all of them, including those two, will be converted into permanent supportive housing, which is a very well-tested best practice for taking people in chronic homelessness, putting a roof over their heads, and giving them the services on site that they need in order to stay stable. And it's been very well used here in King County. lots of people who are now housed or housed because of this kind of approach. And we know that it's needed all over King County, but this is where I have to say voices of people like you all, who are strong advocates for helping those in homelessness, have been so important, because a lot of people don't want us to do this. People will yell at me and say, you got to get them off the streets, get those people off the streets, and then they'll also yell at me and say, but don't put that shelter here, or don't put that hotel for people here. And the truth is, we got to put these things somewhere, and also when they work, these are neighbors. These are more neighbors, just like your neighbors, that will live and they will be part of the community. So we haven't opened those yet. They're not the ones on the east side anyway. We're moving towards that. Part of the challenge has been finding operators. You know, the nonprofits are struggling with staffing, like many people. But the one in Redmond has been open to house refugees. So currently there are refugees from Afghanistan and the Ukraine living there. It's been nice to have that place to put families temporarily until they have a place to land. But later this year, early next year, you'll see them open up for permanent supportive housing. So that's been a really nice innovation. And of course, the Congregation for the Homeless shelter is coming out of the ground. It's starting to be a thing. I'm just so proud and happy to see that happen. That was a King County property. I was a strong advocate for us selling the property to the congregations and making sure that they had a place to do the medical program. And it's so great to see it. I see a lot of nods. I know you all are big supporters, so thank you. Okay. A little bit on the housing front. So, of course, we know from data that people who are in homelessness, many of them start their slot into homelessness because housing is too expensive. You lose your home, and a cavalcade of things can follow that cause people to become very unstable in their lives. And the cost of housing has just been very difficult around here for a long time, and it's only getting worse. I saw a report last week that said the average price of a home in West Bellevue is $3 million. Here in East Bellevue, $1.3 million. Yeah, these little stick-built homes that they built in the 50s are going for over $1 million. It means that young families can't move in. It means that people who have retired and no longer have their full income, if they have high taxes or still have a mortgage, it's very difficult to still afford. But mainly it means that we are losing what they call middle-income housing. There is not enough, but still quite a lot of subsidized housing here in East King County through the Housing Authority and others, Imagine and others. And there's plenty of market rate luxury housing. What there isn't is a lot of housing for people making a working wage. And that just gets worse and worse year after year. I'm reading recently that there may be a market correction, and I don't wish for anybody's property values to go down, but it sure would be nice to have a brief lull in the, you know, stratospheric increase in our housing costs. So, one of the things I've done since I got elected to King County is I formed a task force on housing affordability. We worked for 3 years. It was a partnership of the county and all of our city governments, and we came out with a list of recommendations. One of them was to form a permanent housing, affordable housing collaboration, which we did, and I'm the chair of that now. And we are working on something. I don't exactly know how to explain this to people, but it's gonna help in the long term. You know, cities do comprehensive plans. They say we have to plan for so many jobs, so many housing units. They have to create a zoning map that allows for all of those things. Bellevue's strategy, of course, has been to concentrate most of their growth in housing and jobs in downtown, Belred, like big, dense areas. What we never have done, ever, in planning is say, the types of jobs you're going to have will pay everything from minimum wage up to the CEO of Microsoft. And the homes will cost an amount that is sort of commensurate with the wages that people earn around here. Here, our wages go from here to here, and our housing costs from here to here. So the people who work in lower wage jobs cannot afford to live here. People in service industries, our own police officers. A very large percentage of the Bellevue police force lives in east of Easton. That's just sort of a place where they have happened to buy homes. When the earthquake comes, it would be nice to have them here, right? So we are working on, for the first time ever, building affordability into the plans. It's difficult. These are gross levers, and they don't show up immediately. But if we get this work right this year and next year, 10 years from now, we will have turned a corner, and people will be able to look back and say, that made a difference. So not something that's going to make the headlines. They call them countywide planning policies. Mark it down. It's going to make a difference. It is, really. Okay, so I'd also like to talk a little bit about behavioral health. By the way, I should give you a roadmap so you don't just hear me going on and on. I've got behavioral health, transportation, a little bit about budget and property taxes, public safety, and then I'll stop. Okay, so you know where you are on the map here. Behavioral health is what the experts in the field now call what we used to call mental health or substance abuse addiction, you know, substance abuse services. And what we have right now is a hole in the bucket. There's not enough services. There never have been enough services, not since deinstitutionalization in the 80s and 70s has there been enough services in the community for people with mental health needs. However, right now, the services we do have are going away very quickly. Especially residential beds, whole facilities shutting down. We have something like less than 120 beds in our entire county for people on Medicaid, and that's not enough. So last week, the county executive and the governor announced a partnership to purchase Cascade Hall, which is up by Harborview, which is one of the larger inpatient mental health facilities around here, basically to stop it from closing. So we're stepping in with emergency funding just to keep things from getting worse. And a lot of planning going on right now to think about how do we actually turn that corner and make things get better. So you will hear more about this, and you heard it here first. There will probably be some kind of a taxation proposal to try to fund this stuff because it's very bad. Young people can't get in to see counselors. We have great organizations here in East King County, like from you know, very, very young ones through Kindering Center, Hope Link, all the organizations you can think of. They can't hire people. For years and years, we've underpaid folks in the nonprofit sector compared to government and the private sector, and it's just become untenable. After COVID, they cannot hang on to folks, and so they can't provide the services, and it's really hard. So we'll be looking at King County at ways that we can help to prop wages up in order to get people to take these good jobs and do the work that they can. We're also looking at improvements in crisis care centers, like this kind of shades over to public safety, but it's very popular right now, and it's a good thing for police departments, the sheriff's office, et cetera, to be talking about what they call an alternative emergency response model. In other words, when somebody's having a mental health crisis, don't just send sirens and police officers with guns. Maybe send a social worker or somebody who's a trained mental health professional to try to de-escalate the situation. I think we've all heard of unfortunate situations where somebody in a mental health crisis ends up being harmed or even killed because the people who respond are emergency responders with guns. What they need in order to fully implement this system, which I think will be very, very promising, is a place to go. If you send this alternative response team, or even just if it's not too dangerous, if it's dangerous of a situation, just send a social worker, somebody to help intervene. Where does that person go if they can't stay in the place they're at? There's a conflict in the home or some reason they can't stay. We don't want to take them to jail. That's sort of part of what's gotten us into this problem, is using our jails as substitute mental health facilities. So we need what they call a landing spot. And there's a lot of work right now to try to fund some of those. One in East King County, possibly in Kirkland, where they have already implemented an alternative response system and know they need a place to go. So we're working on that. I want to talk about transportation really briefly, and I have a fun challenge. You may notice I'm standing here sweating terrifically. And the reason why is because I biked here this morning, and I usually need about a half an hour after I'm done biking to sort of cool off. But I use my bike and the bus to get around most of the time, but this week I'm doing it for a special reason, and that is advocacy group for people with disabilities is hosting what they call a week without driving. Starts today. A week without driving is I and others who are participating are going to act as if we cannot drive. Not choose not to drive, which is what I normally do, but cannot drive. So that you get a sense of what it's like to get around in our transportation system if you are completely dependent on transit and other people. And it's pretty eye-opening. I would recommend trying it if you get the chance, because there's a big difference between choosing not to drive and not being able to drive, especially when you have a teenager who doesn't yet have their license. So, yeah, doesn't ride a bike.
Are you giving up the bike for the week as well?
No, I'm allowed to ride the bike. It's part of the challenge, yeah. Interestingly, the head of the group who's running this challenge is a woman with, she wouldn't call herself blind, but she's visually impaired, and she rides a bike. So, yeah, I would love to try that, though. A week without wheels. We'll just go. All right. So one of the things that I have worked on my entire career since joining the city of Bellevue is to try to get the light rail line built to East King County. I have believed very strongly that we should be part of this transportation system. That's part of how people get around when they can't drive or won't drive, because they have got mass transit that you can get them lots of different places. And as you can see, it's so close. you can see the structures, and now they've got the cabinet wires up. It's like, you can, even if you're very, very lucky, see a train coming through every now and again, because they're testing the trains, and they're all parked over at that maintenance base over in the Belred area. But there was some bad concrete work on the other side of the I-90 bridge, and so the agency is saying that the line is going to be delayed by at least a year. I know. That was exactly my reaction, except my face might have hit the table. And also, so I am pushing now to say, hey, look, if you can't open the bridge for a year or more, you've got 10 stations over here. Some cities have whole systems with less than 10 stations. Why not open that? Why not open it from Mercer Island or South Bellevue to Redmond and back again? It'll, you know, put the system in use, get people used to using it. There's plenty of destinations it serves. So that's my current mission. And if there's an ask here, someday I will put out, like, everybody email SoundTrans now and tell them they got to do it. And I will ask that you please do that. It's not time yet, but it will be soon. In happier news, we have made a move now to give out free youth ORCA cards and have reduced the ORCA lift fare, which is a low-income fare for people who can't afford full fare, to $1 a ride. So anybody 18 and under can ride for free. Anybody who qualifies for ORCA lift can ride for $1. And that's about access. That's about making sure people can get where they need to go, which we know is very heavily correlated with opportunity and financial success. So that was super cool to see. By the way, if there are young people in your life and your question is, how do they do this? Eventually, you will have easy access to a black ORCA card. That's the youth fare. We weren't quite ready with those. There was a deadline in state law to take advantage of some funding, so the agencies, they were great. They said, let's just do it, and we'll figure it out later. All you have to do is walk on. If your kid looks like they're 18 or under, they will be free. If they don't look like they're 18 or under, they can say, I'm 18, you know, or say whatever their age is. Please don't lie, but if you say the truth, they will let you on. Okay, budget. King County does a biennial budget like the city of Bellevue does, and we are about to do ours. I'm going to get the number wrong, but it's a multi-billion-dollar every two-year budget. Most of our money at King County goes to things like the bus system, the solid waste system, the dump, and all of the services that get garbage to the dump, the wastewater system, the wastewater treatment plants, and the pipes in the ground. So most of what we do, people don't see, hear, feel, except the bus system is probably the most obvious thing. The jails, the courts, but we have got some dedicated human services funds that the voters have largely put in place that serve a lot of the things we've been talking about today, and we have some flexible funds that we can use for various different things. But the number one dynamic I expect in the budget this year is we're going to have a hangover from the COVID federal relief funds. We pushed through hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in the last 2 years because the federal government came to the rescue when we all had to stay home because of COVID. And we pushed that money out to small businesses, tourism, a lot of nonprofits to assist people with the things that they needed, and all of that stops. And it's going to feel to some of those agencies like a cut. So we're already having people come to us saying, you've got to backfill this money, backfill. King County cannot afford to backfill the federal government. They're way bigger than we are. They have way more money than we do. And they can print money. We have to balance our budget. we don't get to go into debt, and we do not have a printing press, so I think it's going to feel a little bit, it's not a bad budget. It presents as a balance, it presents as a status quo type budget, but it's going to feel like a bad budget because a lot of folks are going to see that what they've been doing, they can't continue to do. Otherwise, okay, 2 years from now, different story. 2 years from now, I think all of the local governments are going to be in big, big trouble. So you'll be hearing about that, but we don't. That's something we build towards. And we try to create a values-based budget. We try to fund the things that meet the community's needs and the things we say we're here for. So I expect that you will see funding for additional funding for land conservation. There's a big push right now to conserve some of the last undeveloped land that hasn't been preserved. For equity, supporting places in our county, we have very, very inequitable results and outcomes in our county. Anytime you put a map on the wall and say, pick an outcome, birth rates, infant mortality, economic success, educational attainment, involvement with the criminal justice system, name it, any outcome you want to pick, the map always lights up red in South King County. There's just a lot of need, a lot of racial disproportionality going on in our county in every possible way. And so we have got some concerted efforts to try to address that, essentially by working with the community to provide the sorts of supports and voice that they need to get what they need. So that will, I don't know what the program will be or what they'll be proposing for that, but it's a whole plan. Okay, last two things, property taxes. So the number one thing in my email right now is I just got my property valuation and it went up by, name the number, 40%, 50%, 100%. I mean, apparently here over here, this part of King County has seen massive value inflation. This does not mean that that's how much your property tax is going to go up. And I spend a lot of time explaining that to people. Property tax is a complicated calculation. It starts with a dollar amount, and then we spread the dollar amount across the entire county based on assessed value and the rates. The rates are set by cities, counties, school districts, and then voted levies. So, yes, our property taxes are probably going up. People should not assume they're going up by 40%. There's been a lot of nervousness about, like, I can't afford a 40% increase in my taxes. If you have any questions about your valuation or your taxes, please do email me. I'll leave some cards here, and we can make sure that you get in touch with folks who can give you more details about your specific situation. I want to make sure people are aware. And I will say to the world, with this video, that what we really need is a more progressive taxing system. Relying on sales tax and property tax is fundamentally putting too much of the burden of our government services on people who can least afford to pay. And we really need to do something about that. At the state level, we advocate for it every year at King County, but we don't have the power to implement it. We need that to help. Okay, public safety. The second biggest thing I get in my email these days are people concerned about increases in crime, fears about public safety, etc. And there's a lot of headaches going on around why is this happening. A big part of what we see here in East King County anyway is always property crime. There's been, of course, this new business in catalytic converter theft. You may have read about on Nextdoor or wherever you do that. So some of the things that we're looking at in public safety are multifaceted. First of all, just starting with, I spent most of my career as a labor negotiator, as an HR manager, as an administrator in the county jail system. So I worked for them for about 15 years. Been a lot in and out of the jails for me. And I will tell you that just locking people up doesn't solve crime. And so that's the place that a lot of folks go. They come to me and they say, we need to arrest more people, lock more people up. What they want is a safe community. I want that too. Everybody wants that. Just locking people up is not the answer. We need a system that does everything. We need something that helps kids get a good launch so that they don't end up in situations where they're desperate or they're acting out of trauma or emotion to do things they ought not to do and harm people. We need a system where people can have access to education and jobs, mental health care, drug treatment, etc., and public safety. Like, this is an and, not an or. So a lot of the debate we have right now is fund more cops, fund more cops, fund more cops, or don't fund cops at all. Fund only you know, diversion programs. In my view, we need both. And so I will be looking for a system that is as balanced as possible and meets people, meets the needs that as they exist, not as we imagine that they exist. So we've done a few things. We moved, as you may know, from having an elected sheriff to having an appointed sheriff here in King County. That's an interesting thing that's in our charter. It's gone back and forth over the years. We just appointed this first appointed sheriff in a long time. Her name is Patty Cole Tindall. She's a lovely person. She's got a really deep experience, but she's not a uniformed law. She's never been a police officer. So she brings both sides. She's worked with uniformed police, but she's not been a uniformed police officer, so she's an interesting leader for that organization. And they will be working on that alternative response, crisis response method that I was talking about earlier, where you pair up with mental health professionals or social workers instead of just sending police to mental health response problems. We have these community-based diversion programs, and those are community-based means instead of we're going to, diversion program is you get arrested, you've been charged with a crime, the judge says, I will send you into a diversion program, go do this thing that we've set up and report back to me, and I'll let you know whether you're off the hook or not. A community-based diversion program says, I'm not going to send you to court at all. We're not going to charge you with a crime. We're not going to give you a criminal record. We're going to refer you to this community-based program that is not part of the criminal justice system. Just, and hopefully it is something that is in your community where you have relationships and they you do their program and we go hands off. And then if that succeeds, that person never comes back into the system because they never commit another crime. If it fails and they commit another crime, then they come back into the system and then we're dealing with the things that we do in criminal justice. This is intended to divert people out of a system that we know ends up with more recidivism than not. So it's interesting, there's a lot of debate about it right now, whether this is effective or not. We're going to keep a lot of data, and we're going to report about the effectiveness of it, but we're just starting this right now. It's called Restorative Community Pathways. There's been a program for youth, and now we're starting one for adults. In addition, we have focusing heavily on recruitment and retention for police officers, corrections officers. There are big holes in those forces, as there are in every single part of our operation and most other communities and agencies. There's just a real labor shortage right now. So we're trying to hire our people and train them and make sure we have enough to do the jobs. Okay, those were the topics I wanted to talk about. And I want to say again how much I appreciate being able to talk to all of you. It's a very polarized environment out there, and it's really nice to talk to folks who I know bring really solid values to governance, to community service. I'm here to help you do the things that you do as well, so I hope you'll reach out to my office if we can ever help you with any of your initiatives, because they're awesome, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
So you mentioned earlier on two interesting points that I wanted to ask, and they're not necessarily related, but they might be a little bit. One was about housing encampment sweeps, and specifically how it sounded like we here in Bellevue deal with it a little bit differently than in Seattle, and I think the problem space is probably, to be frank, quite different. But I know Seattle, particularly from community advocates, they're not fond of the way Seattle handles their housing sweeps. And I'm curious if you have any insight on how we're handling sweeps, how Seattle's handling sweeps, how maybe Seattle could be influenced to perform their housing sweeps in a more community-focused way.
Yeah, that's a great question. Everybody heard that? Okay, because, yeah, I've got the microphone. First of all, to just sort of set the context, Seattle has a very different street context than we have right now with people out on the streets in Seattle. Bellevue, like Mercer Island, like most of the cities outside of Seattle, has made street camping illegal. So they don't allow encampments to form in the first place if they can help it. So from the perspective of the advocates, I don't think that they would say that Bellevue is any better than Seattle. I think they feel that they're equally unwelcoming. But that Seattle, because they have these encampments that set up, they come and they sweep them, that is extraordinarily disruptive and it doesn't solve the problem. It just chases people around and you sort of see things get worse and worse. Interestingly, I hear sometimes from people in cities outside of Seattle that when Seattle does a bunch of sweeps, homelessness increases outside of Seattle, and this is what I'm talking about when I say it's a regional problem. You can't just chase homeless people around and expect that somehow homelessness will disappear if you've done nothing with the root causes. You have to deal with the causes. That said, I have some hope here because recently, through the organization I was talking about, the King County Regional Homelessness Authority, they have done what they call camp resolutions. I think that's the word they use, resolution. They don't call them sweeps, but they disband the camps by getting everybody into camps into alternative housing voluntarily. So it's the same result. You get rid of the tents, you get rid of the street, because people who live in tents have nowhere to put their garbage, nowhere to go to the bathroom. They become pretty unhealthy, pretty awful places. You get rid of all of that, but you do it by bringing people inside into healthy housing and with services to sort of go on their way and hopefully stabilize. So that, to me, is the approach that we should be taking. It's very expensive. It's very labor intensive. We need to scale up our responsibility to be able to do more of that.
Excellent. Thank you. The second question I have was around the comprehensive housing plan that you mentioned, and I'm wondering if you could expand a little bit on what that ends up looking like, because as you mentioned, our housing kind of goes from, for the sake of the people on the audio, very high to really, really high, right? And we have we also have low-income housing that meets, I'm guessing, only a portion of the needs really at that level anyway. And I know that one attempt commonly suggested is we'll increase housing density. As you mentioned, we've kind of done that in downtown and in the Bellarmine corridor. The problem we've also seen there is, okay, we've allowed higher housing density to be created, but what goes in there? Luxury apartments. Most of the vast majority of the time it's that high-end housing, because developers come in and they go, oh great, we can charge $3,000 for a one-bedroom apartment in the Bellarmine corridor. And so we're not really meeting that kind of middle income tier that you referenced, or really the I would say even the not extremely poor to middle income tier. So I'm curious if you could expand on what that comprehensive plan looks like a little bit more.
Certainly. Thank you for reminding me something I forgot from law school, which is that you should say for the record what it is you're doing with your hands. Yeah. Two answers to that question. The first one is process, the second one is substance. The process answer is what we will do in our countywide planning policies is we will set goals. We will say, Bellevue, you need to have X thousand units that are affordable at 0 to 30% of the area median income, or 80 to 120% of the area median income, which is very low income or middle market income. They'll get their numbers, they'll get their levels. Those have to be reflected in their comprehensive plan. So the city then goes and has to make a plan. And the comprehensive plan is basically just a map and some policies that says, we'll allow this amount of housing here and that amount of jobs there. But they have to do something that when you look at it objectively, seems likely to allow enough of the right kind of housing to meet those different levels of income. Then they have to take that comprehensive plan map and policies and put it in their zoning code. And anybody who's been through any zoning hearings before, greatest quote I ever heard from Joe Biden, I was actually at an event he was speaking to long ago, and he served on a local council once upon a time, and he said, there's nothing I do that's harder than zoning hearings. I'm never doing another zoning hearing. So you have to go through all of that, all the zoning hearings, and then what happens. The builders build, the builders don't build. People sell, houses, it's a long-term plan, and you have to adjust. If you don't see in the world what you planned for, you have to adjust your plans. That's the process. The substance is, in reality, what the city ought to do, what all cities ought to do, is they ought to allow more housing in more places. Some of that will be affordable if there's enough of it. If there's not enough of it, it's all unaffordable. So that's the market approach. But in my opinion, they also should when you allow a bunch more housing in some place, like the Bell Red or something, suddenly the property values go up a lot. The private property owners make bank on this. Require some of that to be affordable. That's what they call inclusionary zoning, and we should do that. Redmond does it, Bellevue does it, Bellevue should, and we should do more of it. So those are the sorts of levers they have, and the process hopefully drives more using of those levers. But it's complex. These are, as I said before, gross tools. They're not fine. Like, people say to me, why don't you just require this? And the answer is, not facetiously, because we live in a free country and I don't get to tell everybody what to do with their property. So, but we have ways to push in the right direction. Yeah.
I have knowledge of a pastor who was priced out of his housing and had to retire because the housing that had been affordable turned into condos. Is there anything that prevents affordable housing turning into unaffordable housing?
So if it's affordable, like subsidized government housing, there is. We have a number of programs that incentivize or pay for affordable housing, and they come with requirements on them. But usually they expire, and I think we should make them permanent. So Bellevue's got a tax exemption incentive program. If you build a certain type of housing, you get an exemption from property taxes for 12 years. Well, at year 13, what happens to that property? It flips and it becomes fully market rate, and the people who can afford the lender can't anymore. For market housing, what we call naturally occurring affordable housing, there's no controls. If it's private, it's private. And so this is why we need things like renter protections, more notice, more ways that people can, you know, sort of be able to stay stable in their homes, not get fined out of their homes for like minor misses. One of the changes that was made recently that I thought was great was requiring that landlords must allow a one-time shift in the rental due date. So if you are on a fixed income and you get your checks on the 1st, if your rent is due on the 1st and you don't pay it on the 1st, you could get on that downward slide to being evicted. Make it the 15th, so they've got a few days between getting the check and paying the rent. It's like a simple thing. The rent gets paid. And then we talk about ways to actually do some form of rent protection. You know, it's not legal in this state to do rent control, but are there ways to help keep the rents from going up suddenly and displacing people? There are, and I think we should be talking about those as well. I'm sorry to hear that about the pastor, though. That's sad.
One more question, and then it's time to go to church. Anybody got another question?
Yeah. Just real quickly, you spoke about moving people out of tents inside. What do we do with the people who do not want to live in housing or some type of place? I've heard of people who don't, they just want to live outside.
Right. It's a really good question. In the first place, my understanding from spending some time working with people who work in this field and have done so for many years, they have, not me, that's a lot fewer than we think. Mostly people who don't want to come inside don't want the things that come along with the particular inside they're being offered. Here, come sleep on this mat on the floor with 40 other people in the room. No, you can't bring your stuff or your dog or your partner who's a different gender than you. They don't want that. If you make it more like since COVID, in COVID we had to spread people out for public health reasons. We couldn't have people on mats on floors. They would all give each other COVID. So now we're giving people a room with a door. Lots more people say yes to that. Little privacy, place to store your stuff, lock the door when you leave. I don't have to carry everything with me or stash it somewhere. I can have a pet. It's a big thing for people. It's a big emotional support, actually, for many people. So I think that the number of folks at the end of the day, if we provide decent, humane housing that will say no, is not as high as people assume. But there will be some. And for those, I mean, we need to keep working with them. My personal belief is that I don't think that it's right to say, as they do in Seattle, that anybody can sleep anywhere, or as some advocates do, anybody can sleep anywhere and we have no right to move them. That's to balance rights. You've got to balance rights. One thing that we have is we have people in the disability community saying, I can't get through this sidewalk because there's no room for me in my wheelchair. we need to balance the rights of people who have nowhere to be and center the folks who are like the least able to help themselves, at the same time not making it impossible for other people also to live. So ultimately, I think we do have to tell people who will not go inside, here's a place where you can be. You can't be over here. We haven't gotten there yet, though, because we've never really offered enough housing to know how many people will say no when we have enough. And I think we got to try that first.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good question. Tough question.
If anybody has any other questions, stay around for a couple of minutes. Yeah. And Claudia will give you a business card.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.